Hi, friends. Maggie Creech here, host of Revolution Revisited. If you've been tuning in, you know we're diving deep into the people and stories that made the American Revolution what it really was. Messy, bold, and full of rebellion right here in Virginia. And if you've learned something new or found yourself saying, wait, I never knew that, I'd love your help spreading the word. Wherever you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, leave us a rating or a quick review. It only takes a few seconds, but it helps more listeners discover Revolution Revisited and supports the work of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, the team behind this show. Every review keeps history alive and keeps Virginia's stories in the spotlight as we commemorate America's 250th anniversary. So go ahead, hit those stars, drop a line, and keep spreading the word. Thanks for listening and for making history with us.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble-rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. Spoiler alert, we know how the American Revolution ends. And for Virginians today, it might seem obvious that most people would have thrown their lot in with the Patriots. But hindsight is a luxury that people at the time didn't have. For them, the world was uncertain, dangerous, and profoundly divided. Choosing a side wasn't just a philosophical exercise. It could determine life, death, and everything in between.
When you were in elementary school and you were learning about George Washington and the American Revolution, it all seems like it was all going to go really well from the get-go. Things were happening. We had Paul Revere. We had George at the helm. They were going to win, obviously. And it was in no way obvious. And it was super messy. And there was political mess. There was family mess. There was economic mess. It just gets to be so complicated so quickly.
In 1775, the idea that 13 colonies could challenge and even defeat the greatest empire on earth was, in the minds of many, almost unthinkable. To commit to the Patriot cause was to stake your life and property on a gamble against a global superpower. What if you picked the wrong side? What if the British crushed the rebellion? These questions were ever present, haunting conversations in homes, taverns, and marketplaces across Virginia.
I think fear is certainly one of the motivations for choosing one side or the other. On the ground, I mean, people are making life and death decisions.
To help us untangle why some Virginians chose, or were suspected of choosing, the crown, we are joined once again by two familiar voices. Their expertise sheds light on the lived realities of people navigating a world where every choice carried profound personal and social consequences.
My name is Andy Talkov, and I am the Senior Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
I'm Christina Vita. I am the Elise H. Wright Curator of General Collections at the Valentine Museum in Richmond, Virginia.
In a period where patriot fervor swept across Virginia, being a loyalist wasn't just unpopular. It was dangerous. Communities, courts, and local governments actively prosecuted suspected loyalists. Lands were confiscated. Families were threatened. Violence was a very real possibility. And yet, the loyalists didn't vanish. They persisted, quietly, strategically, often at great personal risk. For historians, this creates a challenge. How do we reconstruct these hidden networks? How do we know who supported the British and why?
I mean, you might switch back and forth in your loyalties. It's interesting what you say about how would they know if someone was a loyalist or not, because it then raises the question, how do historians know how many loyalists there were? And that's of great debate. One of the ways are these court cases. Of course, all of those cases, the way they're reported, are colored by the people that are reporting it. And those are the patriot-like tribunals. The other way that historians may know about loyalists is through the Loyalist Claims Commission. And for Black Virginians, the way that you can sometimes get to those stories is through the Book of Negroes, where many Virginians appear before they, you know, evacuate New York and go to somewhere else in the British Empire. So there are some ways, but as you said, if you're surrounded by a bunch of armed patriots, it's unlikely that you're going to wave a flag and say that you're a loyalist. And so it's very difficult to understand, well, how many people were loyalists? Most historians say now that they think maybe 20 to 25% of a population of maybe 2.5 million people were loyal. And I think the question is, why doesn't it seem like the loyalists can get their act together and push back against the patriot cause? I mean, they also have the might of the British Army behind them. And I think most historians suggest that the loyalists tended to be much more spread out in regions and didn't have the kind of effective leadership that the patriots had.
By the mid-1770s, Virginia's most influential politicians were firmly in the patriot camp. These men who were delegates to conventions, leaders of local militias, voices in the public sphere, shaped the pressures and consequences that loyalists faced, both socially and legally. Reconciliation with the crown was no longer on the table. Submission was no longer seen as an option. Then there's Dunmore's Proclamation of 1775, a moment that altered the stakes entirely. And if you need a refresher or want a deeper dive into the Dunmore details, head back to episode 3 of this season. The proclamation promised freedom to enslaved people owned by patriots as long as they fled to fight for the British. Many historians categorize these individuals as Black loyalists, but that label obscures the complexity of their experiences. Some joined voluntarily, seizing a rare opportunity for freedom. Others were coerced or compelled by circumstance. Some were displaced, and some joined as substitutes for their enslavers. But they all faced new forms of uncertainty and danger once the fighting ended.
The term Black loyalist is a little bit misleading because I think for enslaved people, the conflict wasn't really a question about your fealty to the king or parliament. Or injustices about taxation or representation or all these other ideological things. Their real decisions were between freedom and enslavement and which side would most likely be able to provide the safety and security and potential freedom that they were seeking. If we think about loyalists as the decision about supporting king and country or supporting a rebellion, I don't know that the majority of the Black people in the colonies were making that kind of decision.
Harry Washington is probably the most famous of these Black loyalists, and his story was highlighted in episode 3 with Andrew Lawler. Washington's life encapsulates the tension between hope and peril that defined the experience of Black soldiers who fought for the crown, a struggle for freedom, recognition, and survival in a world that remained hostile even after the guns fell silent.
Harry Washington isn't the only one of Washington's enslaved people that actually escapes with the British. One example is a woman identified as Deborah. She's 16 years old when the British show up at Mount Vernon in April of 1781. So she's a really good example, and she's not the only one. So when the British show up at Mount Vernon in April of 1781, she and 16 other enslaved people escape with the British. Frederick, Gunner, Harry, Stephen, and Waddy were all tradespeople and artisans. Thomas was a house servant. Thomas, Esther, and Peter were enslaved people that were young, like, you know, 16. Three of them were described as old men. And 7 of that group of 17 people were eventually returned to Washington after the British surrender at Yorktown. And there are plenty of examples of enslaved people finding freedom behind British lines. So she ends up being sent with the army to New York City. She marries, while there, a fella named Harry Squash. And Virginia didn't legally recognize marriages between enslaved people. But now that she was in New York behind British lines, she had the ability to do that. Harry had been enslaved to a loyalist named Lynch, who had bought him from a British Army officer. And so the British Army in New York formally recognized Harry and Deborah's marriage. In April of 1783, she leaves for Nova Scotia with like the 3,000 other Black freedom seekers who form the community at Birchtown. And she apparently appears in a 1784 census at Birchtown, but her husband isn't listed. So, I mean, a lot of times we kind of lose track of people after they go to Nova Scotia. She's one example, and I think a good example of one of many people who left as a group.
Much of what we know about Black loyalists comes from the Book of Negroes, a meticulously compiled record created by Brigadier General Samuel Birch. It lists roughly 3,000 men and women with names, ages, and descriptions, individuals who were evacuated to Nova Scotia as free people of color after the Revolution. For Christina Vita, curator at the Valentine Museum, these records provide not just names, but traces of lives, the human stories behind revolutionary movements, the ambitions, sacrifices, and resilience of those who navigated a world defined by conflict and inequity.
Most of those names that are in that book are not from Central Virginia. There's only 12 that are from Central Virginia. But the stories of two of them, I think, are great. Samuel Mason is 25, and his wife, Polly, who's 26, arrive in Canada in 1783. They're listed in these books. They come on the ship Esther. And Samuel had been enslaved by Colonel Allen. It's written as Cavan or Cavan Point, most likely Cabin Point in Surrey County along the James River. And then Polly had been formerly enslaved by Dick Sharp of Richmond. So you've got this couple that are able to actually reunite and seek freedom together. Both of them said that they had left their enslavers 3 years prior, so in 1780, that they had left ostensibly to the security of the British forces at that time. And we don't know anything else about Samuel and Polly Mason other than they arrive in Nova Scotia, are listed in this account.
Another important group to consider are the merchants of Virginia. While collective boycotts beginning in 1774 showcase the power of grassroots activism, they also inflicted real economic hardship. Port towns experienced declining trade, lost profits, and disrupted supply chains. For many merchants, choosing the Patriot cause, or even appearing sympathetic, came at a tangible cost to their livelihoods. These economic pressures layered additional complexity onto personal and political choices, showing that allegiance was as much about survival as ideology.
The economic messiness, the familial messiness of how are people going to make these choices absolutely comes into play. You've got tobacco merchants that are so financially connected to Great Britain, England in particular. But if you are, you know, a Hanover tobacco merchant like Hardin Burnley Jr. was, and your whole livelihood is sending these barrels of tobacco over and then getting in these orders of goods for your friends and neighbors, you're thinking, well, what am I going to do if I can't continue to do that, right? Whether it's because of the physical barriers that are going to happen during war or the economic relationships that are going to break down. And so Hardin Burnley is like, no, I am a loyalist. I'm not signing that oath of allegiance. Like, I am absolutely sticking it out with the British. And by 1779, he's forced to flee to New York. His property has been, I'll use another big word that they used in Virginia in 1779, escheated. They've confiscated his property with his wife and children still here. And then he's like, oh man, that's really bad. I'm in New York and my kids are like still in Hanover County and my property is being taken over. What am I going to do? He tries to come back and they're like, no, you cannot come into Virginia. So he's forced back to New York. He finally makes it back home and he's placed under house arrest. And the neighbors are talking about it, right? Like the neighbors are writing letters being like, oh my God, Burnley, he's under house arrest, like no good for him. if you have any loyalist sentiment, like, do not be talking about it right now because things are not great here in Virginia for the loyalists. And so, you know, he's making that choice. Now he and his family have enough money to be able to finally move all the way to London.
While loyalist sentiment certainly existed in Virginia, New York was a true hub of British sympathy, and ideas from there often spread southward through networks of merchants, lawyers, and families. One key figure connecting Northern Loyalist networks to Virginia was John Wickham, whose trajectory illuminates the long tale of allegiance and adaptation.
So John Wickham is born on the eastern edge of Long Island, which is a Loyalist stronghold during the American Revolution. So it is 1778. He is 15 years old. I get the sense he's a bit gangly. His uncle is like, oh my God, we got to do something with John. His uncle is Edmund Fanning, a general in the British Army. And his uncle writes very forceful letters to his sister and his brother-in-law. Copies of these letters are in the VMHC collection, saying, please let John come with me. And John's father, also John, complicated, John Sr., and his wife Hannah are like, yep, sure, little John, go on, go enjoy the war. That's going to be fun for you and your uncle. Edmund Fanning then is now in charge of John Wickham. Still at this point, John Wickham Jr. Edmund Fanning in 1780 is like, we are all going to Virginia because what are the British doing? They are going to Virginia, right? So John comes down on a boat to Virginia, and he is carrying papers between folks in the British Army, and we don't know who they were going to go to, but these papers are apparently trying to convince some Virginians to support the British cause. And he's wandering around Southside Virginia trying to get to his uncle, his other uncle's house, we're not sure, and he gets caught with these papers from the British Army. And as one would, right? Everyone is on high alert. The army is finally here. Things are actually happening in Virginia during the American Revolution. And you have this youth doing dumb things. So he gets caught and he's placed under house arrest by Thomas Jefferson. We have Jefferson's writings about the story where he's like, no, this man is an enemy. We cannot let him go free. He can stay with his uncle down in Greenville County. So he does. He stays with his other uncle. And while he's at his other uncle's house, he writes a letter to his dad. He's like, man, Uncle Edmund really did not do me well. He let me wander around without a flag, a white flag, saying that I was peaceful. Now, do we think that John Wickham was posturing? Yes, we do, because he escapes from his uncle's house and he goes to Nova Scotia, where he signs his actual admission to the British Army in 1782.
This document, preserved in the collection of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, highlights a fascinating detail about the winding conclusion of the American Revolution. While the last major battle was fought in 1781 at Yorktown, Virginia, and more on that in season 3, the war itself didn't officially end until 1783 with the signing of the Treaty of Paris. Wickham's story is a window into the complexities of post-war life for loyalists. Wickham traveled to London and Paris before returning to New York in 1784, and finally to Virginia in 1785 to study law under George Wythe, the same mentor who shaped Jefferson, Marshall, and Monroe. By 1791, he opened a law practice in Richmond, where he continued to advocate for British companies and loyalist individuals in the courtroom, all while integrating into the social and legal elite of the new capital city.
He has turned his legal career to be very successful by fighting for the debts of the British companies and the British and loyalist landowners who were trying to get back some of the money that was owed to them by Virginians. And he is successful.
Consequences for being a loyalist or even suspected of being one varied widely. Some lost property or financial stability, and others were socially ostracized. Some rebuilt lives in Britain, and others navigated a path within the new nation. Wickham, for example, married into a family with patriot leanings, and ultimately amassed wealth and influence as an attorney, demonstrating that adaptability, timing, and personal networks could reshape the trajectory of even a former loyalist.
Virginia had been really hot on paper against Tories and against loyalists. Like, the laws, even 1783, they're not letting loyalists back into the Commonwealth. They're like, no, stay away, go back to wherever you were trying to come from. But by the 1790s, when the court cases start to get settled and the financial affairs of the country are coming into order, Virginia's like, oh, actually, it's a lot easier if we just resume the status quo.
Yet for many, suspicion alone could trigger hardship. Communities, courts, and neighbors scrutinized behavior, sometimes punishing even perceived disloyalty with social isolation, economic penalties, or worse. Revolution, by its nature, creates a climate where intentions cannot fully contain consequences.
One of the things about loyalists that can be confusing and up for debate is, what did you have to do to be considered a loyalist? When the British Army shows up, is allowing them to water their horses considered being a loyalist among some rampant patriots? That may be the case, and there may be retribution for that, despite the fact that there was an army on your doorstep, you know, like armed soldiers. So what kind of choice did you really have? But to the people that were in your community, they may have seen that as showing loyalist sympathies or being a friend to the king. So this fellow on the eastern shore named Shadrach Furman supplied the British with provisions when they came to his farm in 1781, in January of 1781. In his account, as he was trying to get reparations for the damage that was done to him, as part of his claim in the Loyalist Claims Commission, he said that the patriots, quote unquote, wounded him in diverse parts, had him stripped, gave him 500 lashes, and left him for dead. He said that he lost his eyesight and the use of one of his legs from an axe wound that one of them inflicted on him. He did what seemed to make the most sense to him, and he actually fled Virginia as a result. And so he fled on a privateer to Portsmouth and enlisted with Captain Fraser's Department of Pioneers. So these were Black individuals who supported the British Army by doing engineering work, digging entrenchments, building fortifications. And so he was one of about 500 Virginians who made claims with the British after the war as they tried to make reparations to people, to loyalists who had been harmed or damaged during the Revolution. So I'm not really sure what choice he had at the outset of that experience, but certainly his choices became clear as his neighbors not only demonstrated extreme racism likely against him, but also these types of punishments were metered out over their white neighbors too, who they thought were supporting the British.
One striking aspect of revolutions is how little control leaders have over the intensity of popular fervor. Intentions, whether noble, pragmatic, or self-interested, often give way to unpredictable social and political consequences once the tide of action begins.
I'm Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. A few years ago, learning about the forgotten meaning of the pursuit of happiness changed my life. When the founders wrote that famous phrase in the Declaration of Independence, they meant an ongoing commitment to self-improvement and lifelong learning. This discovery inspired me to write a book, and in my new podcast, I explore the founders' lives with the historians who know them best. Plus, filmmaker Ken Burns shares his daily practice of self-reflection. Join me for Pursuit, the Founder's Guide to Happiness.
Mary Willingbird, for instance, was accused of loyalist sympathies during and after the war. Born in Philadelphia in 1740, she married William Byrd III in 1761. Byrd himself supported the crown through the fall of 1774, speaking with disdain about the frantic patriotism of some Virginia leaders. He even went so far as to write a letter offering his service to the king in July 1775, after the formation of the Continental Army. However, Dunmore's proclamation in November 1775 proved a step too far, and William Byrd III reversed course, unsuccessfully seeking a position in the Continental Army throughout 1776. However, his late turn to patriotism and a recent decade of unpaid financial debts meant that his peers did not grant him the position he sought, and Byrd committed suicide in January 1777. After his death in 1777, Mary Byrd inherited the Byrd family's estate, Westover, in Charles City County. Despite her strong family ties to many serving the British cause, including her first cousin, Peggy Shippen, Benedict Arnold's wife, Byrd attempted to remain neutral during the American Revolution to preserve her property for her children. However, in early 1781, British forces under Benedict Arnold raided Westover, seizing enslaved people, horses, and other property while moving into the house and confining Byrd to certain rooms in the home. Byrd's efforts to navigate the incident and recover her property led to formal charges of trading with the enemy. She defended herself eloquently in a letter to Governor Thomas Jefferson, stating, "I wish well to all mankind, to America in particular. What am I but an American?" Her trial was scheduled but never held, and she continued to manage Westover until her death in 1814. Her story reminds us that gender intersected with politics in complex ways. Women could be scrutinized, threatened, or punished, even when not formally involved in military or political action. An anonymous letter in the VMHC collection, signed Veritas, appears to defend Mary's actions during the war, stating, "Under such circumstances, never had a human being a more difficult part to perform, suspected on both sides." We've spent much of this season tracing the choices people made once the colonies were at war. The patriots who rose up, the loyalists who held fast, and the millions caught somewhere in between. But what about those who refused to choose a side at all? Not out of apathy, but out of conviction. For the Quakers, or the Religious Society of Friends, neutrality wasn't a political statement. It was a spiritual one. Rooted in a deep belief in pacifism, many Quaker communities could not, in good conscience, take up arms or pledge allegiance to any military cause, British or American. When the war came, they stood apart, not as bystanders, but as people of a particular principle, navigating a world that increasingly demanded loyalty through violence. Their story reminds us that in a time of revolution, sometimes the bravest act of all is to refuse to fight.
So there's a pretty sizable Quaker population here in central Virginia, including, and in particular, the Curl's Neck meeting that's in eastern Henrico. Robert Pleasance is one of the main leaders of the Curl's Neck meeting, and he is an ardent abolitionist. The Quakers here, the Society of Friends, they decide to not pay the extra taxes that are imposed to support the war effort. There's a double tax that is applied to the Society of Friends members because they are not paying their share to support the Commonwealth during the American Revolution. There's actually a triple tax that's voted on, but then never actually collected. And then they are also, of course, encouraging their younger members to not fight in the war. And Robert Pleasance, even in 1781, the British are here, right? Like Benedict Arnold is here in Richmond. They are at his neighbor's house in Henrico. And he is writing about he's had theft from his house by the British. They've destroyed his property. And what he is most concerned about is his son and his son's friends going and fighting for the Patriots. He's not as concerned about his personal property or his physical personal safety. He's actually held overnight by the British in 1781. He's terrified, though, that his sons are going to abandon all of their sort of religious beliefs and go off and fight for the Patriots, which was super attractive for 18-year-olds, you know, and young 20-somethings to go off and like fight for the cause. And he's so grateful and writes to his brother when it becomes clear that these young men are not going to go off and fight for the Patriot cause. So this is a major difference here in Central Virginia, that you have these voices not necessarily full-throated supporting the Patriots.
This steadfast devotion to pacifism often came at a steep personal cost: exile, imprisonment, and suspicion from both sides of the conflict. In September 1777, nearly 20 Quakers, among them Samuel Pleasants, brother of prominent Virginia Quaker Robert Pleasants, were forcibly exiled from Philadelphia to Winchester, Virginia. Their so-called crime? A refusal to swear an oath of loyalty to the revolutionary state of Pennsylvania. They were detained for 7 months without ever being charged, a sobering reminder that neutrality could be treated as treason in a world divided by war. Robert Pleasants himself became a complex figure of moral conviction and contradiction. Though he was born into a slaveholding family, he emerged as a leading voice in the fight to reform Virginia's manumission laws. Laws so strict that even enslavers who wanted to free those they held in bondage were forbidden from doing so without state approval. Pleasants petitioned the Virginia General Assembly to loosen those restrictions, arguing for freedom as both a legal right and a spiritual duty. Yet, like many of his contemporaries, his own life reflected the paradox of that era. He himself a slaveholder, bound by an inability to legally free his enslaved laborers, yes, but also a man who attempted to retrieve at least one person he enslaved from the British. In 1781, when British troops raided his estate at Curl's Neck, they seized a horse he valued greatly. In a letter to Benedict Arnold, Pleasants demanded the horse's return, along with that of a boy named London. In doing so, he revealed the complicated moral terrain of his world. A man of conscience writing to a traitor in a nation still wrestling with the meaning of liberty. His letter reads,
"I had also two Negroes who went away at the same time, the one a man called Carter Jack, between 30 and 40 years of age, and the other a boy about 14 or 15 named London. He says, as to the man, he was behaved in such a manner as that I care little about him. But the boy, who I have been told was over persuaded or forced away, perhaps by the said Jack, his uncle, I am very desirous to reclaim. If, therefore, you will be kind enough to give direction for the said boy and horse restored to me, it will very much oblige."
It's through sources like these, personal letters, military rolls, and bureaucratic lists, that we catch fleeting glimpses of the lives history nearly erased. One such life is that of London, the teenage boy mentioned in Robert Pleasant's correspondence. His name later surfaces on British muster rolls and the inspection roll of Negroes, records documenting those who escaped enslavement to seek refuge with the British Army. London made it to Canada in 1783, one of thousands of Black loyalists who followed the British promise of freedom. He died there just 2 years later, in 1785, a teenager who saw a narrow opening toward liberty and seized it, only to lose his life before that freedom could fully take root. And as for Robert Pleasants, his moral struggle became a legal crusade. In 1782, his efforts were rewarded when the Virginia General Assembly finally passed a law allowing slaveholders to free their enslaved people without state approval, a watershed moment in a state that had long resisted even voluntary emancipation. Pleasants immediately freed those he enslaved and went further, filing a groundbreaking lawsuit to secure retroactive freedom for more than 400 people promised manumission in his father's 1771 will. He would spend the rest of his life fighting for the spirit of that law, pushing the Quaker community to expel members who refused to free their enslaved laborers, just as they would those who took up arms in the Revolution. He brought freedom suits to court, argued for the rights of Black Virginians, and helped found schools for free Black children. All of these radical acts in their time. In 1785, he wrote to George Washington, delivering a sharp moral rebuke that still echoes today. "Remember the cause for which thou wert called to the command of the American army was the cause of liberty and the rights of mankind. How strange then must it appear to the impartial thinking man to be informed that many who were warm advocates for that noble cause during the war are now sitting down in a state of ease, dissipation, and extravagance on the labor of slaves. It was a reminder that the revolution's rhetoric of freedom rang hollow without universal emancipation, and that even in victory, America had yet to win its own moral war. And so, as we've seen throughout the season, the question of which side to support was never a simple matter of Crown versus Congress. It was shaped by myriad shifting forces: geography, race, religion, family, fortune, and could change as quickly as the winds of war. Allegiance wasn't always a matter of ideology. Often, it was a matter of survival. For some, the war arrived literally at their doorstep in the form of soldiers demanding loyalty oaths, armies seizing crops, or enslaved people seizing the promise of freedom. For others, the decision was made for them by birth, by bondage, or by faith. Every act of loyalty or defiance was filtered through circumstance and agency. And for many, that agency was limited, fragile, or fleeting. In the end, the revolution wasn't a single story of heroes and traitors, patriots or loyalists. It was a patchwork of human choices, stitched together into the messy fabric of a nation still trying to decide what freedom really meant.
They were individuals who had the ability to make choices, right? And define what their own course of action was going to be and how that was going to affect others in their communities. And then there were people who didn't necessarily have the freedom of choice. And all of that is occurring in the same, can I use a really fancy word? Can I say milieu, right? Like, it's all happening together. And not everybody was making the same choices, and not everybody was in lockstep agreement.
These stories collectively complicate the binary notions of good and bad. Both patriots and loyalists engaged in action that could harm communities, and both were guided by a mix of idealism, loyalty, fear, and circumstance. Revolutionary choices were rarely clean or predictable. They were human, they were messy, and they were consequential. This complexity extends to every layer of society, from the prominent politicians to the marginalized and overlooked. Sometimes decisions were shaped by upbringing, community, and circumstance, but sometimes they reflected something intrinsic to the individual, something that historians can only speculate. Thanks to our guests, Andy Talkov and Christina Vita, for sharing their insights and helping to illuminate the complicated lives and choices of Virginians during this turbulent era. For those interested in seeing these stories brought to life, the Valentine Museum's upcoming exhibition, Dissent, opens in February 2026. It will explore how Richmonders navigated the Revolution and early Republic, grappling with questions of freedom, loyalty, and the meaning of civic duty in a world transformed by war. For more episodes and resources, including the primary sources mentioned in this episode, check out our website at virginiahistory.org/podcast.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Riley Reynolds, Nicole Martorana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.